Well, my name is Alice Rossall, and I'd like to welcome you all to the first of this year's Frieze Talks at the Frieze Art Fair. And our theme today is good taste, bad taste. So taste is a very old-fashioned word and a rather unfashionable concept. In fact, it's so old-fashioned and unfashionable that when I told someone yesterday that I was taking part in a debate on taste, they thought I was saying that the debate was on Tate, and I actually had to spell the word T-A-S-T-E until they finally understood what I was talking about. And it's easy to see why taste seems so rooted in the past. It's as derided in high culture by its association with crusty aesthetes like Bernard Berenson as it is in pop culture, where it's kind of been subsumed by snobbery, and people who consider themselves to be tasteful are routinely mocked in sitcoms. Think of Basil Fawlty. It's a great example. So it's testimony to how muddled our concept of taste has become that the language used to describe it is extremely confusing. On the one hand, if I describe somebody as having good taste or bad taste, you'd know exactly what I meant. But if I said that they just had taste, that would automatically mean they had good taste. And if I said something was tasteful, I'd mean that was in good taste too. Whereas tasteless and distasteful obviously mean bad taste, and as Paul Valery said, taste is made of 1,000 distastes. But if you actually look at the formal definition of taste in the Oxford English Dictionary, which is veered from the 15th century as being the fact or condition of liking or preferring something, or in the 17th as a mental perception of quality, to in the 18th a style or manner exhibiting aesthetic discernment, you can see why it's particularly pertinent to everything that's going on around us at the Frieze Art Fair. So our objective in this debate is to explore what taste means to us today. Is it relevant or irrelevant? Is it useful? And if it is, who defines it and what does it mean? So to guide us through the taste minefield, we've enlisted the help of the writer and curator Teodad Zolgada, Thelma Golden, who's director and chief curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem, Carlo Antonelli, who's editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone Italia and a professor of sociology, and in case things get really rocky, we have an eminent psychoanalyst and Darian Leader. So they're each going to give a brief presentation on what taste means to them. We'll then have a discussion between us, and you all have the chance to pitch in with comments and questions. So we're going to begin with Teodad Zolgada, who's a writer and curator who contributes regularly to Frieze magazine. I'm sure a lot of you have read his work there, and whose recent short film, Tropical Modernism, addresses the history of the Iranian left. Teodad is currently preparing an exhibition at the Covent Gallery in London, a contribution to Manifesto 6, and if that wasn't enough, for the publication of his novel, Softcore. Teodad.
Thank you. We're going to go through these five images which we were invited to pick out, and I'm going to go through them one by one and talk about what I consider is good taste about them. Due to the intricacies of email, I'm not sure if I've done exactly what was expected of me, but you'll see that these five images all convey a notion of good taste in some sense or another, like radically different senses of the term. And they don't necessarily form a coherent whole in any other sense of the term. So the first image kind of speaks for itself. Everybody here, I'm sure, knows the top 10 pick in every issue of Art Forum, and obviously there's these kinds of, you know, marching orders in many other magazines too. The current wallpaper issue has a 10-year anniversary and a list, you know, the ultimate pantheon of sofas and hat racks. In Art Forum, obviously these lists are meticulously researched because nobody wants to come across as predictable or as hokey in the pages of Art Forum, and these lists always convey good taste in that sense, in any case. And obviously I was also interested in this image right here and now because it kind of overstates what we're trying to do here, squirming to do justice to this privilege of, you know, maybe not being arbiters of taste, but somehow supposedly having access to some kind of to an aesthetic truth or other. Next, please. So this, as some of you will guess, is Jean Baudrillard. Back in the 60s, what's eerie is that he didn't look very different back then, and I was interested in this picture because I'd heard this rumor that he was going to speak here, and apparently he really was going to speak here, and apparently now he's canceled. And everybody who knows his rantings from the 90s will be just as surprised as I that he agreed to do that in the first place, where he was talking about a complete end game in the arts in terms that were not exactly tasteful, perhaps. I mean, what I've always admired about Baudrillard is that he always so eagerly, willingly, and excitedly put his foot in his mouth, and so eagerly conveyed a sense of improper taste, like when he was talking about Desert Storm, when he was talking about 9/11, and when he was talking about contemporary art. And this is certainly not what you could say about his fellow post-structuralists. The picture, obviously, would also be interesting in terms of taste, you know, the retro fashion, the paraphernalia of the Parisian penseur. It's all very attractive. The next image, please. This is the former Japanese head of state, Koizumi, who, on one of his very last state visits anywhere, last summer he decided to visit Graceland in the presence of Lisa Marie and Priscilla Presley and George Bush. And he took his time, and he apparently annoyed pretty much everyone by doing air guitar and Elvis poses, and by singing Don't Be Cruel and Love Me Tender and many other evergreens. I tried to read up on it in different newspapers, and I was quite impressed by how the press reacted, because obviously everybody was amused. But usually when this kind of thing happens, the media pounces on this kind of figure and tries to stylize it into some kind of cross-cultural pathology, try to prove how this poor individual is trying to be white. You had this when people discovered Saddam Hussein's Rococo living room furniture. You even had it when, you know, people started analyzing Condoleezza's particular sense of Chanel. And here, suddenly, when it came to Koizumi, there was none of this silly racialized psychoanalysis. And I don't know if it's because Japan is considered now, you know, having joined the dinner table, or whether it's because Koizumi was such a taste icon in his own right. Like when he was elected, there was all this fuss about his hairstyle, and his hairstyle was transformed into this emblem of, you know, change, radical change in Japan. And that's pretty much all we can remember from his time in office. I mean, as a Eurocentric newspaper reader, that's all I can say. This is a poster designed by a Swedish artist based in Gothenburg called Lars Nielsen. Not to be confused with the older Lars Nielsen, who lives in London, I believe. This is a younger artist by the same name. This is an example which pretty much speaks for itself. It's kind of somebody trying to strategically indulging in bad taste while insisting that the person is actually in very good taste. You get a sense of this with, you know, the humor and with the design. I think it kind of like speaks for itself in terms of taste politics. And the last picture, please. I don't know if you can read the caption on the guy's t-shirt. It says, "I hate homework." This is a scan of a poster of the MTV produced TV show called Wonder Chosen. I don't know if you are familiar with this show. It's a parody of Sesame Street. Sesame Street for adults, basically. The show deals a lot with the commodification of political icons, of radical icons. This is the main sort of Muppet of the show. I've forgotten his name. And he's wearing this Abu Ghraib icon on his t-shirt, which I think is, and I know I'm sticking my neck out here, I know I'm kind of asking for it, but I think it's quite an interesting thing, because they're not waiting for the usual kind of media digestive cycle to run its course, and you know, to turn this into a kind of political trinket. It's still oozing with blood and guts and embarrassment, and that's what makes it interesting because perhaps at the risk of sounding theatrical, what is going on right now in Iraq and elsewhere, I don't know if you've read the Guardian this morning, is very much akin to old school colonialism in every sense of the term, like from the cultural humiliations to the decimation of populations to the financial benefits, that it's packaged in a relatively tasteful way compared to previous onslaughts. And the opposition is also quite tasteful. It's quite, how to put it, it comes across as self-congratulating very often, even if it, in essence, is not. It's just, I think it's more a problem of trying to formulate critique in a constructive way, going beyond something which is very tastefully recuperated.
Well, thank you very much. Well, thank you, Teldad. We'll now move on to Thelma Golden, who's one of the most influential curators of our time. She joined the Studio Museum in Harlem in the year 2000 as curator, and for the last year has also been director of the museum, and before that she was a curator at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York and also a consultant to the collectors Peter and Eileen Norton. Throughout her career, Thelma has encouraged us to reassess the role of African American art in art history and contemporary culture. In this debate, she's going to talk to us about an experience of her work as a curator when she was forced to work very much against her taste. So over to Thelma.
Thank you, Alice. As Alice said, when forced to consider this question of good taste or bad taste, I really could only begin to think about this as it relates as a curator to just thinking about my taste. And, you know, sort of the unspoken as a curator is that you're always operating in the realm of your own taste and in many ways presenting and framing your taste for the public. In thinking about this issue of good and bad taste, particularly as it related to the area of interest for me, working with artists of African descent, I first have to tell a personal story by way to get to the exhibition I created. About a decade ago, after purchasing their first home, a really good friend of mine and her husband bought their first work of art. This was a very big deal for them. And it was their first serious purchase. It was the first thing they bought to hang on their walls. It wasn't a leftover college poster or something bought on holiday. And it symbolized, in their mind, the beginning of their collection. After they bought the work and hung it up, she called me up and invited me over to dinner. And when she mentioned the name of the artist that made this work, and I didn't recognize it, there was this sort of pregnant pause on the phone, and I knew sort of the road we were going down. Now, I knew when I was invited over, there were sort of two things at work. Quite specifically, I knew that her husband, my friend's husband, wanted my opinion simply to confirm that they hadn't spent too much money on this painting. In his mind, I was an art professional, and he just wanted an assessment. As if I were a lawyer, you want some legal advice, you called him up, and they gave it to you. He just wanted me to come in and say, it's good, it's bad, you didn't spend too much. But my friend, she actually wanted something much more important for me. She wanted me to confirm her sense of her good taste. And I knew this because there was a certain urgency in her desire to have this conversation. So when I got to their house, I was immediately ushered into the living room. The painting was hanging in this place of honor. And I looked at it for a very long time and then kind of uncomfortably said, it is very nice. And I realized in my whole career as a curator, I had never described a work of art as nice. My euphemism of choice, now I am confessing something, for work I don't like is interesting. Because, truthfully, even if I don't like it, usually I am interested. The painting they had was large, and it featured a black woman in a contemplative pose. She was indoors, but near a window, and the sun was streaming in, and she was sort of looking upward at the sun, and it was just on her face, and she was sort of smiling really beautifully. It was very beautifully painted, gorgeously framed, very expensively framed, but it was completely undemanding. It was perhaps even beautiful, just in the way the woman was featured, but unchallenging in its beauty. It didn't really seem for me to warrant a repeated viewing, and it really went against everything I personally thought art should be. I saw this work and had this complete encounter with this idea that in the end, even in an unspoken way, my sense of good and bad was very much defined in my own curatorial practice. So having this encounter with a work outside of it made me want to explore that curatorially. Now, I have often had many conversations which allow my curatorial practice to expand with the artist Guan Maigong, and I put this to him, this idea of this kind of overwhelmingly figurative, really idealized idea of positive images of black people in painting, and quite literally my utter repulsion for it, the fact that it made me almost allergic. Quite often I'd had the experience of encountering these works of art and the artists who made them, and it was somewhat of an antagonistic encounter, because it was very clear, if one looks at any show I ever made, that this is not where my own intellectual framework is or would be curatorially. So I thought, what can happen if one then makes that a curatorial exercise? What can happen if I actually made a show of works I absolutely hated? And not simply to make it because I hated them, but really to explore what this issue I had with a very established genre of work. I mean, this is not a side thing where a few people are doing it. It was a very big arena, big realm of practice. So I don't think I knew at the time that I could really answer this question, right? How taste informed my own curatorial practice adequately. But I thought that entering into the domain in the sense of an exhibition would in some way coalesce these experiences, both personal and professional, with the encounter. My own approach to curatorial practice was one that assumed an exhibition as a resolution to an intellectual or aesthetic inquiry. That notwithstanding, I valued the space of an exhibition as the perfect site for encounters that would not feasibly, because of this big ideological gulf, happen in the world. That is, I didn't think this would be worked out in my friend's living room. I couldn't really have a conversation with her about how horrible I found this painting, or quite conversely, how she might have found many of the works of art that I might have suggested in its place in that way as well. I also had to take into account institutionally that I was working in a place that had defined the notion of the kind of work that black artists made, and this arena was even outside of our own ideological framework. So I was looking at the ways in which taste is defined, personally and institutionally. I needed to come to terms with this because I didn't not just want to respond, but I also wanted to see what it was that I found so horrific. This is a work by Alexander Austin, an artist in Kansas City. Representative, can I have the next slide, please? Clifford Darrett, Thanksgiving Dinner, this is called. I did not intend this exhibition that I eventually made, which I titled Black Romantic, to be a critique. An exhibition of this sort as a critique for me, or even just a conceptual exercise, would have been too easy intellectually as a way into this topic. Before committing to this project, my relationship to this world was informed by my perceptions. I was often very physically unsettled by the kind of work that I found to be overly sentimental. I perceived to be strident in its approach to picturing the black world and problematic in the way in which it figured authenticity as a lingua franca. I shuddered in many cases at the crass commercialism that was sort of rampant in the reproduction and the self-promotion of many of these artists. I seemed caught in a clash of values, and I could not read past any of that. Mostly, I was suspicious of this notion of the real, the idea that these images position themselves as being about a real, and in their sense of taste, that realness or authenticity was part of how taste should be formed. So I made this exhibition through an open call, invited artists from all over the country who made work. I described what I was looking for and allowed them to present their work to me, and I made the selections with no judgments around an idea of my taste, but as representative of the opposite of what my taste might be. I hung all of the work in the museum, again, without a sense of a curatorial structure around it that came from me, one that was defined by the artist, and perhaps most importantly, allowed the audience for this exhibition to understand it in the way in which the artists understood it themselves. What was most complicated about this is that it really did change the idea of how I could be a curator in this, because essentially it was work that I didn't or couldn't even adequately defend. I could defend its presence, I could defend the ideas that the artists were working with, but I couldn't defend it within my own sense of a curatorial view of work in the world. I also, however, was interested in the way in which my audience would also encounter this work, if they would see the idea of the exercise I was making as ironic, or if they would look at it as being conceptual, or if simply they were encountering this work as the artist intended it, without any of that veil at all. Next slide, please. These are artists from all over the United States, many of whom show and are reproduced and have catalogs, exist in a whole alternative universe than the one I worked in. And final slide, Kadir Nelson. This is called Africa. Many of these works have titles that are equally as striking in the way in which they read as the work. Now, here's the reality. So I did this very confident about my taste. I understood that I was entering into a very complicated terrain. I wrote an essay in the catalog in which I owned up to not liking the work, which even in of itself was a hard thing to do as a curator, to sort of open up that sense. It's usually the unspoken, right? What you like is sort of what you're showing. So having to say I didn't like it. Making the exhibition changed not my taste, not at all, but it changed my sense of how taste can be understood. Because in the direct encounter with these artists and their work, of course, I had to create a way in which I could at least have somewhat of a dialogue, which as a curator and an artist was a complicated one, because there was this space between us in terms of what we thought of as good and bad. And that dialogue and that debate, perhaps, was for me, still lasts. I mean, the show was about 3 years ago, and it still continues between me and many of these artists, Kadir Nelson in particular, whose work I'm showing now, have been having this dialogue since. So the idea that taste, it can be formed, but it also is a place that perhaps one can enter into, feeling firm in one's own taste, but also begin not to so much look at it as good and bad, but allow a dialogue to exist in the differences. Thank you.
Thank you, Thelma. Our next speaker is Carlo Antonelli, who's the editor of the Italian edition of Rolling Stone. He's also worked in the music industry and the film industry, and in his spare time, he's a professor of the sociology of fashion at Bologna University. He recently published a book on the history of the Italian dance movement in the post-war era, which I'm sure is better pronounced by a proper Italian, but its title is Disco Inferno, Storia del Ballo in Italia. And Carlo is going to take a rather nihilistic approach to taste and explain why he doesn't believe in it.
Very briefly, Alice introduced this debate, saying that taste maybe is not a useful notion anymore. Maybe we have to recap a little bit why we have to consider this notion surpassed or gone by. And thinking about it, and thinking from my personal point of view, experiencing a strange emotional situation in these months, and because I'm thinking that I'm changing my skin, and even while I'm doing my work as editor-in-chief, it's different the way I look at things right now, because I think we are experiencing a big shift in cognitive terms, in what we see, in what we like, in what we think is okay for a publication or something like that. I decided not to show any images, because if you are into this kind of transition, taste doesn't make sense anymore, because it's not a playful pleasure in a way. It just reminds you of thing purchased in an airport mall, or an opening full of people, or just a brief look at to a designer building, which are not that interesting to me at the moment. So thinking about it, I don't think this is a personal situation. I think that this is a real point. Why? Because taste, and let's recap a little bit the notion, is a thing of the past. It's part of past centuries, is a 16th century notion, is a 17th century notion, is an 18th century notion, and of course a 20th century notion. It's part of the past modernities, is the rise of urban bourgeoisie. It's a social tool. There's a great study about taste, which is a very famous one, and a Pierre Bourdieu study of 1979 called The Distinction. And Bourdieu very clearly explained why taste is a subtle political tool, which structure, of course, social relations. It's a perfect machine of exclusion, like everybody knows. It's hierarchical, it's vertical. It's part of a structure of layers that is controlled by several gatekeepers, with few on top and many at the bottom. It's a tool for the affluent class. And from the times of the now buried debates from, you know, high culture and low culture, the clever exhibition of so considered bad taste was also a part of it. If you consider part of the affluent class, the creative class that was born from the shift to post-Fordist production of the late 70s. Mass media culture, of course, is involved in it as a comparison. But the vector is the same, it's still an old rule from the periphery to the center, from the bottom to the top, blah, blah, blah. The underground movement, and also this underground movement that Tadara explains about it, about, you know, how tasteful can you be in playing with political subjects right now, are part of it. The Pomo taste, the Boho taste are part of it, the Mitro and Ubersexual taste is part of it, the bad painting, the new German expressionist are part of it. It's all very boring. You know, it's always very boring. We are now living in different times. We are not living in a hierarchical system anymore. This is our times of total unimportance of the center. People start living in a different way, we start living in a different way, and we don't start to consider the center anymore as a focus. There's only one exception, the new world affluent class, which is reasonable, obsessed by affluent tasteful objects. The new ever-changing snobs, the not-so-noble world, we know that snobs come from a very clear word of the 19th, means in Latin sine nobilitate, without nobleness. Those are the consumers of the so-called luxury items, including contemporary art, one of the great discoveries of the last 10 years, and a smash hit in the top 10 chart of the global luxury commodities, a great investment, and something that declares your status between people. In this sense, we are in the middle of an observation field, because, of course, we are in the middle of the Frieza affair, and we can see it from the inside. And between those consumers, the same class that still thinks that fashion is still fashionable, that brands are still brands, that Marc Jacobs is always Marc Jacobs, that Bourdieu inclusion and exclusion system is always working. But it's a quick fast lane to improve yourself. It's a great tool to transform yourself into something better, more refined, like you are a guest of a designer room, of a designer hotel, of the mid-90s. And it worked 10 years ago, but it's not working anymore. It's predictable, it's made by the same gatekeepers and tastemakers and coolanters, and of course, cool is a dead notion as well. It's a ruin of the past, it's a 50s notion. It's cold and it's unpersonal. I was looking at my designer room tonight, the 10 years old anniversary of wallpaper, and I was thinking how sad it is in a way. How distant, how irrelevant. Think of the gastro-elitism in a way, you know, the boom of gastronomical products and how banal it is right now. And this is just to remind how taste is also a gustatory quality. It comes from the mouth, it's palate stuff, and it's part of maybe our central nervous system in a way, you know. We don't forget that the first meaning of the word is related to the limbic, literally, system. For this class, the transformation of individuals into fast-lane corporate androids is a very fast project. It's a predictable game run by other anxious runners. It's part of what Peter Sloterdijk, a German thinker, recently declared as the greenhouse effect of the global wetness of the market. And that's why it's tiring, in a way, because taste includes the notion of death, of course, because it leaves dead bodies on the ground, the bodies of the now uncool things, the old tasteful and now hateful objects, the memory of your past self, in a way. He was talking, taste as a notion, of desire, sex, cultivated knowledge, self-expression, and again, death. And now, simply and banally, taste of money. It's interesting on a planetary world of view because, of course, we can be excited about the fact that new consumers are entering into the field, new financial citizens of the world, Central Europe, India, the now a little bit passé China, Russia, South Africa, Turkey, Tunisia, Morocco, according to The Economist or Business Week. But also this excitement is becoming a little bit tiring in a way. And we don't forget that also taste is a violent notion. It's a battle between group of consumers, and it presumes disgust, of course, against other. And it presumes a Darwinian struggle, which is, you know, something we have to think about. But new times are different. At times they are marked by the rise of multitudes who don't care about the structure and the center anymore, as I said before. People who don't care about construction and structures, who don't participate in symbolic words anymore. People who think that the beauty of life is formless, is made of contradictive amount of emotion, that are impossible to be locked in the cage of good and bad taste. The beauty of life is anew, as Derrida used to say, is undiscontractable. It's something that leaves him room and space for the other. It's non-objectifiable, it's not soluble, it's a secret. And it's personal, like taste never was, because taste is just a floating meeting of a textually inscribed aesthetic value where good and bad are on the same time of the aesthetic spectrum, while the other is completely empty. Somebody said that we are experiencing a shift between a third-person market and a first-person market, but maybe. There is one mass-market book which is called The Long Tail. It is written by the white editor-in-chief called Chris Anderson, described the actual situation. Anderson says we're living in an age of infinite choice and unlimited demand, where the notion of taste, good or bad, is completely unimportant. We are living, to quote, a muddy, indistinct proliferation of mini-markets and microstars who don't aspire to be part of the center anymore. Of consumers' habits, they are very far from being aspirational, just individuals who reveal their likes or dislikes through their behavior. We are ungregarious consumers with a broad set of colliding tastes. We are micro-connoisseurs of many similar and unsimilar disciplines instead of shoppers. And the shift is from a mass culture to a massively parallel cultures that are not marked by the cultivation of any possible taste, because we can be proud of our bad taste in cinema, our excellent taste in art, we can be dressed in an horrible way and be owners of apartments in incredible designer condos. And this is our identity at the moment. It's an out-of-joint galaxy. It works on a real planetary scale where taste is a dead bourgeois problem, and real consumption of identity works in a completely different way. If we think about the way to move of a foundation in Milan called the Prava Foundation, we can understand the way the work is not related to a common aesthetic quality anymore. It's determined by emotional performances of singular expression of intensity. Restored Russian movie of the 20s, debates, temporary exhibition in art fairs, relevant initiatives on the territory, in general, flow of thoughts, which is an unresting will to understand contemporaneity. This is just one of an example of contemporary behavior from a company who has marked on a worldwide scale the notion of affluency in the recent 15 years. And that's why, for us, for me, the definition of taste is a ruin of the past, it's a useless tool. We have our life, we are cool, we are untasteful, we are tasteful, we are finally free. We don't follow in social idols, we don't like socially functional stuff anymore. We don't trust those who are say that there's a deep significance in taste. We don't want to be clever anymore. We are sentimentally different. Our social, in terms of community, publics, in terms of political sphere, and self-identification doesn't come from this old stuff. And maybe it's time to make two or three questions. If today the personal point of view, as I said at the beginning, is not relevant inside this scenario, how do the different micro-communities can determine the aesthetic value? Do we have to consider the old notion of taste in terms of pure performance or everyday life, or practice of everyday life, following one very old essay by Michel de Certeau, and not in aesthetical terms? Is maybe the point of authenticity of behavior a good starting point?
Thank you, Carlo. It's now over to Darren Meader, who writes regularly on psychoanalysis and contemporary life. He's published a series of books, all with their intriguing titles, such as Why Do Women Write More Letters Than They Post?, Stealing the Mona Lisa, Why Art Stops Us From Seeing?, and coming soon, Why Do People Get Ill?, On the same Magdalen note, Darien's next book will be on mourning, melancholia and the arts. He's now going to explore the meaning of taste and why, from a psychoanalytic perspective, we find ourselves drawn to some works of art and repulsed by others. Over to Darien.
Thanks, Alison. So, let's start with a vignette fresh from yesterday evening's glittering Deutsche Bank party. A collector detailing his purchases of the day, speaking with great excitement about three works that he bought that would be perfect for his new home. He explained to the group that in his new home there was floor-to-ceiling windows in the wall in the main reception room, but the walls were punctuated by three recesses, and the works that he just bought were perfectly matched to fill the three recesses. And he talked about how pleased he was to have found the works that had exactly the dimensions to match the recesses in the wall. Now, you can imagine the effects of this horrifying conversation stopper. A kind of silence in the group, an embarrassed air, followed by the swift dispersal of all members of the party. From an art historian's point of view, the vignette is quite illuminating when we think about the history of taste. For this particular person, there'd been a coalescence of beauty and utility. He liked the works, but the works really had a value of use because they fill the recesses with exactly the right dimensions, no excess space. When the concept of good taste, or as it was called then, fine taste, was being formed in the 18th century, it was often defined in its separateness from the idea of utility. So fine taste meant a refined kind of pleasure which didn't involve any use of an object. The collector's excitement, his exuberance, would also have disqualified him from showing fine taste, since it was often argued, again in the 18th century, that if you showed too much exuberance accompanying your appreciation for work, that made you show low taste rather than fine taste. Now, those are two art historical perspectives on the encounter. From a Freudian point of view, certainly for a Freudian like me, when someone talks about having recesses filled, having a hole filled up by a work of art, it's difficult not to come up with a kind of elementary shrink interpretation of that. You can't really stop hearing that. Now, what matters though is to see this vignette less as a kind of aberration, a grotesque example of what good taste isn't, than rather as bringing out some of the mechanisms present in all forms of taste, and in particular, in all forms of so-called good taste. Why? What does the vignette show us about that? First and foremost, it shows us something about reasoning process. That in moments where we make aesthetic judgments or choose to acquire works, there'll be processes of reasoning present, a kind of logic, which might not be apparent to us at a conscious level. It's not clear that this person would have been alert to the Freudian implications of talking about having his recesses filled. But there'll always be a hidden logic or hidden rationality behind the choices present when we acquire or when we're drawn towards or propelled away from works of art. Now, when the concept of taste was being minted, particularly throughout the 18th century, it was defined as something that would generally operate to split up groups of human beings. It had a kind of logic of segregation. Fine taste was something that you either had or you didn't have. And when it was discussed, it was...
Yeah.
Okay, how's that?
No.
Any better?
It's back there.
Okay, sound people.
Can you just speak up while they
fix it?
Okay, can you hear that?
Yeah.
So, let's go back to discussions of taste in the 18th century, whereas the question of using the notion of taste to segregate human groups. Some people had taste, other people didn't have taste. For example, women, paupers, the idle rich, the native inhabitants of the colonies. There was a kind of segregation implicit, which I think we've just heard about from the last speaker, in discussions of taste. And it always ended up by dividing human groups. It was either something that you were born with or it wasn't.
And if you were born with it, you might be able to acquire it through education and cultivation. That means that taste, in that particular conception, as it grew out of the split between fine taste and low taste, was something which always depended on convention. It always involved how we imagine one looked at by other people, how we imagine the social world looks at us, how we're situated within it. And that's why, for example, in some historical periods, bad taste can be good taste. You have good taste to have bad taste. All those awful 70s artifacts in your living room will be a sign of good taste at one moment and of bad taste at another moment. It's also why, when people are asked to explain what they like or dislike about works of art, their answers tend to be very different from what they might really think about them. The notion of taste, in that sense, isn't so interesting. It's fairly useless, because all it's telling us is about how people wish to be perceived. And again, I agree entirely with what the last speaker has been saying about how the notion of good taste situates you socially. If we accept that, the poverty of this distinction between good and bad taste, isn't there still something interesting in trying to think about what attracts us to certain works or what repels us from other works? What makes us move towards or move away from works of art? So I'll take two examples, again, very, very schematically. In the first example, a man became fascinated by a particular sculpture. He wasn't a collector, and he persuaded the gallery to sell him this work by a well-known artist, despite the fact that he wasn't an established collector, and despite the fact that he had to make considerable sacrifices in order to be able to pay for the work. Now, when he got it, he had a lot of problems. He positioned the sculpture in his house, but he was never satisfied. And in his analysis, he talked about this perpetual dissatisfaction, the fact that he'd have the statue moved from one point to another point in his house, but he was never sure about why he was anxious about it, why there was something unsettling, and why there was always this feeling that the sculpture was in the wrong place. At a particular moment, he linked the look of, it was a figurative sculpture, to something, an important time in his childhood, linked to an aunt who had taken care of him. And the moment he made that realization in his analysis, rather than that enriching his appreciation of the work, he immediately put it in storage. He didn't want it in his house. Now, it's interesting because, in a sense, it's not really telling us very much about his appreciation of the work. What matters isn't the association of the aunt to the sculpture, because after all, how can we ever relate to works of art without making connections to episodes from our childhood, our history, our family? Rather, in this particular case, what was so interesting was the gesture of rejection to immediately put the sculpture in storage. It implied that there was a character of defense in his relation to the work, which also applied not only to his relation to the sculpture, but also in his relationships, where the moment that his girlfriend became linked to an image of that particular aunt, he'd immediately end the relationship. Now, that shows us that often the things that we're most drawn to, the works of art that we're most attracted to, aren't necessarily those that we like the most. There's a difference between what we're attracted to and what we like. But also, that I think Gombrich was right in a remark he made once, that when we think about taste, thinking about why we like works isn't really so interesting. It's much more fascinating to look at why people are repelled by certain works of art. Gombrich is very interested not in why we're drawn to works, but why certain works provoke hatred and hostility. He thought that was the right track to approach them. Second example, actually, let me just make another point here. Now, this person who bought the figurative sculpture didn't buy any more artwork. But let's just suppose for a moment that he did. Let's suppose that he went on to collect all the works by that particular artist. Or let's suppose that he went on to collect a series of works which were reminiscent in some senses of that initial sculpture, which evoked at an unconscious level the look of his beloved aunt. Now, in those cases, there'd be a certain fetishistic flavour to the collection of works by the artist or the collection of similar works. They all bear the hallmark of his own personal desire. And we can say that when we find collections which seem to bear that stamp of the particular passion of the collector, often we see those collections less as collections and more as works of art in themselves. And we can think, for example, of certain famous collections of brute or outsider art, where the collection itself seems to be an artwork due to that fetishistic flavour that comes through. It shows that they're a very interesting link between the idea of taste and the idea of collecting. To be a collection as such, wouldn't the group of works have to be separated in the very precise sense as to include also the perceived look of the other, the perceived look of something from outside oneself, from the social world, rather than simply being, let's say, the remnants of one's own unconscious desire? In other words, there has to be something that breaks up the link between the collection of works and our own passion. And that brings us to the second anecdote. This is from a passage by the art historian James Elkins, who talks about, as a child, his Saturday morning visits to local museums. Elkins' father would take him and his siblings to a museum, and he'd offer a dollar reward to which of the children would first be able to find the work that would please him, the father, the most. It's interesting to see that Elkins went on to become an artist and then an art historian of some note. He's written some fascinating books. So, the children would disperse in the museum and they tried to find works, not that necessarily pleased their own eye, but that pleased the eye of the father. And doesn't this give us a crucial clue when we think about what attracts us or repels us to works of art? The idea that we never look at works of art with our own eyes. That even when we think it's a question of our innermost personal taste, that there are always external forces linked to how we think someone else looks, how they look through us. Those forces are always at the heart of our own private experience of taste, preference, and aversion. How we imagine someone else looks. And isn't that why there's a particular feeling reported by people when they're in love and they go to an art gallery? They're wandering around the gallery and they're looking at works as if they were looking through the eyes of their loved one. It's a very beautiful description of that by Stendhal in his book about love, where he talks about seeing the amazing spectacle of the orange groves in bloom outside of Genoa, and he says that this astonishing natural beauty only made sense for him to the extent that he was looking at it through the eyes of the woman he loved, who wasn't there with him. If we take that seriously, that thread in the question of tastes, doesn't it imply that we're always looking partially through other people's eyes? And that when we think about what taste is, it's never something that belongs entirely to us.
Thank you, Darian. Well, Carlo very passionately and eloquently shot down any notion that taste is relevant to contemporary culture, saying that it hit its sell-by date precisely 10 years ago and its relevance ceased then. And yet, both Tirdad and Thelma, equally eloquently, described examples of how they had identified taste in their working lives. So, do you agree, Tirdad, is taste relevant to us now?
I do think it's relevant. Nonetheless, I would agree with a lot of what you said. I do think that taste is in many ways a very problematic term, but that's what makes it so useful. It's what I like to call a terminological Birkenstock. It's not exactly sexy.
Can be.
It's pretty hard. It's kind of in your face. You can't talk it away. And I think the taste for all these potential fascisms that you mentioned, I mean, this is what does go on in the consumption of art and culture as we know it. And I think that taste is very often an extremely useful term, it's like third world, for example, mm-hmm. which in some ways is, you know, is not functional anymore as a analytical tool, and in some ways it is, and it puts one's finger on a painful spot. And I think in that sense, taste can be very relevant. Perhaps it's a tactical relevance.
Thelma, do you find it a useful term?
Well, relevant as it can be redefined. I think when we acknowledge that it's still operational, perhaps broken, but still existent. I mean, that was my, revelation, that it still was existent, unacknowledged, but existent, and existent in arenas that weren't necessarily explored, that, yes, then it still, for me, has a place.
Carlo, what I wasn't clear from your talk was whether you felt taste in its sort of old-fashioned definition, this 18th century construct, is finished in that sense, or whether taste in its purest sense as the exercise of discretionary judgment is also finished.
I was talking only about historical terms. What I was trying to say, and I completely agree with Tonda, that it can be used as a tactical tool, for sure, is that simply we are shifting from an idea and a reality of scarcity of aesthetic goods to a reality of abundance of aesthetic tools. That's the real shift. Because, of course, this comes in a very banal way from the digital age. You know what I mean? Everybody has a digital photograph machine, the net, and that's the real situation. You know what I mean? Before, the notion of taste was coming from small amount of aesthetic value, you know what I mean? Nowadays, we are dealing with an unlimited amount of aesthetic value disposable, and that's the real shift, you know what I mean? That's why it's not a vertical notion anymore, but it's a horizontal notion, which is something else. That's it.
So, Darian, how do these social changes and cultural changes that Carlo has alluded to influence the collections that you were describing?
All those old notions of taste are still around, they've just changed their form. And that human groups are always desperate to find ways to divide up their inhabitants. And so the defining features of taste might have changed from, let's say, the early 18th century to the late 18th century, from the 1970s till today. But human groups always need to introduce new notions of what's valued, what isn't valued, what counts as good taste, what counts as bad taste, in order to segregate themselves. So I think that even by rejecting the idea of taste, that's still a judgment of taste. I mean, these things don't go away. Their form changes, but the basic logic of splitting doesn't change.
May I ask you a question? What's the difference, in your terms, between taste and pleasure?
Well, people don't admit easily what their pleasures are. They tend to deceive both others and themselves about their pleasures, and many people aren't aware of what gives them pleasure. They often feel it consciously as pain. When people talk about taste, it's generally, as I tried to show, when they're asked by other people or by society to say what they want, and there they're going to be making certain statements, judgments, which will matter because it depends on how they want to be perceived. Let me give you an example. They did a survey recently where they asked a large segment of the British population if they'd donate a kidney to a stranger, and more than half of the British population said that they would. Now, if that was true, then there'd be no shortage of kidney donors. There's a difference between how people want to be perceived and what they're actually willing to do. So many people buy works which they're not really that interested in. More and more they employ other people to function for them as their taste. And this is a very interesting, more modern development, in the same way that more and more in today's society, people are employed, experts are employed, to make taste judgments for us. In the same way, my friend Slavoj Žižek says, that people get their video recorder to record films off the TV, knowing that they're never going to watch it themselves, but they're kind of happy that the machine has enjoyed it for them. It's there somehow. In the same sense, people buy things for other people's affections, and this generates a very, very interesting psychological tension, because the collectors that are spending the money on the works through the people who are employed by them are never happy that other people are spending their money, even if they say that's what they want. It's quite similar to the feeling of outrage that many people have when their entirely legitimate credit card bill arrives at the end of every month.
So, sticking to to the arena of bad taste, which Darien has argued very convincingly is something we feel more comfortable around than good, with the possible exception of Thelma. Do you feel, Thelma, that people are more confident and more articulate discussing bad taste and negatives and oppositions than they are in actually sort of pledging their lot with something they genuinely believe is good?
I think people are, but curators are not. That's the difference. I think that, I mean, that's the experience that anyone who works in a public institution has, of course, in the realm of contemporary art. People are very willing to discuss their dislikes or to express them and to frame them in the realm of taste. But as a curator, often that is the unspoken. What you present, you're presenting either, you know, naively as taste or perhaps with more power attached to it as good taste. And so I think that that's perhaps where, for me, the problematic was, that where's the space to present your sense of what bad taste might be.
And Teda, in your choices, you did analyze your sense of bad taste. You seemed most interested and engaged by the images that flirted with danger, the taboo.
Well, what I was trying to do was also push the definition of what taste, good taste, bad taste could be. It was kind of not completely honest to say that they were all my very personal idea of good taste. They were more examples of good taste in a sort of official way. And I think that's the only way that you could really talk about it, because it's a social construct, and with that it brings certain hierarchies. And on the other hand, there's ways of undermining it and subverting it. And what comes first? How does it change over time? If you take it out of context and you try to discuss it as an absolute, then it kind of bites it at its own tail. And so I was trying to find examples where taste was being problematized without necessarily going in questions of good or bad.
Are there any questions from the audience?
A quick question. Could someone relate the concept of taste with the concept of morality, and specifically, is the immoral always tasteless?
Okay, Carlo, is the immoral always tasteless?
That's a very complicated question, as you know what I mean? All the loads of philosophical studies of starting from the Jung one, talking about these kinds of things, you know what I mean? So I don't think I can enter into the question. For sure, the immoral, as you said, is a notion that can be played in the same field, that's for sure. That's maybe a long question.
Teodad, a lot of the images that you showed did raise questions about morality as well as questions of taste.
In a way, you answered your own question too, because you're playing on the fact that traditionally what is immoral is seen as tasteless. To decide, you know, case by case on whether this particular tastelessness is immoral or vice versa, it would kind of explode your question into too many different directions.
Darien, what do you consider to be the relationship between the two?
I think that to answer the question, one has to separate morals and ethics in the classical way, that morality is what society determines as good or bad, and in that sense, what is immoral is tasteless. Ethics isn't to do with what society sees as good or bad, but it's about how faithful one remains to the causes of one's action. In other words, the more that one follows the forces that are driving one, the more faithful one is to those without compromising, without taking into account the demands of other people, that will make one's action ethical. And historically, generally, when people follow ethics to a certain kind of purity, it's seen as immoral, wrong, terrorist, because it always goes against the social rules, which are defined by compromise. So two different angles.
So on that uplifting note, morally as well as aesthetically, sadly we've got to bring this discussion to an end. So I'd like to say thank you very much to Tidda Zoldegaard.